I love the way social media allows anybody to express their opinions and provides a channel through which people can speak, especially when so many people feel like they don't have a voice in their everyday lives. That's all, yay, internet. But there is something about the cultural moment we are in, when opinions are presented as facts and groups gather online to denounce all bad things. Cancel culture has morphed from a necessary taking of power against toxic and dangerous people into a way groups now respond to anything they don't like. It seems like all you need to do is find a couple other voices out there who agree with you on some topic, like a Star Wars movie or some Netflix film about divorce, and that thing can be destroyed. It feels as if people simply can't not like something without that thing becoming a manifestation of pure evil. Because I'm completely insecure about my own opinions, this negative social mob response makes me avoid even watching these movies or listening to the songs or consider the political candidate because I have not memorized the purity test used to gauge what I am allowed to like. What if I watch something and kind of like it only to find out the mob said no? What's worse, as a playwright, I am now afraid of people not just disliking something I've written, but instead going online and destroying it. I can handle people not liking my work. I can't handle people walking all over it Godzilla style. What the mob doesn't care about is the sincerity with which a lot of this work is created. These things they seek to obliterate were not frivolous acts. A lot of people worked really hard to try and make something good. You don't like it. That's fine. You know who does? Other people. And that should be okay. These two things should be able to exist simultaneously. Listen, we all make crappy things from time to time. Those of you who aren't in the business of creating things for public consumption can still understand the fallibility of people. Not everything comes out perfect. But some things do come out perfect for some people. So you don't like the film Marriage Story, and you've got reasons? That's great! Just remember, there's a line between your feelings and facts. The Last Jedi didn't perfectly extend the story of Star Wars to your exact specifications? Totally understand. Just know that 1,000 people worked on that, and none of the choices they made were in vain. They weren't a group of idiots. They were talented people working hard to make a good thing. And that's all we can hope to do. I just wish people would spend less time cultivating their negativity and instead just dismiss the thing they hate and move on to try to find the next thing they might love. Didn't Yoda or some other Jedi say something about letting go of your hate? Take their advice! For those of you who aren't actively trying to cancel art because you don't like it, please be aware of the cult of anger that grows around these things. Try not to feed it, because your friend or partner or child may actually like something you don't. And that's fine. Welcome to the subtext, my friends. I am the host, Brian James Polak. On the podcast this month is Claire Barron, author of Dance Nation and You Got Older. Before we get into the conversation, I want to mark the end of year two of this podcast with American Theater Magazine. We don't do podcast seasons, so there's no natural time to stop and reflect. Over the past 2 years, I've interviewed dozens of playwrights from all over the country, and I'm really proud of how they've turned out, and I'm glad to be able to share them with you. This is a niche thing I do, a playwright-focused podcast, so it's not exactly everybody's cup of tea. That's why hearing from you has meant so much to me over the years. Your emails and social media posts are the best, so keep them coming. And please continue to share this podcast with people, particularly students and new writers. There is so much wisdom and genius recorded in all these episodes. They can do a lot to help people find their own voice as they make their path through this weird industry we're in. If you want to hit me up on email, it's thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to follow my tweets, you can find me at subtextpodcast. Claire Barron is a playwright and actor from Wenatchee, Washington. And I think I'm saying that right, Wenatchee. Wenatchee, I don't know. I don't know what the alternate would be. So let's just say Wenatchee, Washington. Her plays include You Got Older. It won an Obie Award for playwriting, a Drama Desk nomination for Outstanding Play, was on the Kilroy's list, and was a Susan Smith Blackburn finalist. Her play, I'll Never Love Again, was a New York Times and Time Out Critics picks. Other plays include Baby Screams Miracle and Dance Nation, which premiered at Playwrights Horizons in 2018 and won the Relentless Award established in the honor of Philip Seymour Hoffman. She's also the recipient of a Whiting Award, or is it Whiting Award? W-H-I-T-I-N-G. How do you say that? I should know this, shouldn't I? And the Page 73 Playwriting Fellowship, as well as the Paula Vogel Award at the Vineyard. This is me speaking with Claire Barron just a few days ago at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago.
How many people drive here? I feel like I'm surprised by the number of people I meet with cars.
Yeah, well, I took the train here because where I live is on the L, but where I work is not public transportation friendly, so okay. I'm driving, which is the worst. I came here from L.A., where you're tied to your car, obviously, and when I moved here, I was like, oh, great, public transportation all the way, I don't need my car all the time, and then I got a job where I need my car all the time. Such a bummer. You're here for a while, right? You're here for a couple weeks?
Yeah. I came for the first week of rehearsal, then I went home for a little bit, and then I came back for the last week of rehearsal in the room.
Mm-hmm. What's your... This is such an interviewee question, but what is your relationship to your play now that it's had, like, a couple pretty big productions, right? Like, do you still... You know, when you have a world premiere, like, we're so in it and deep in there in the rehearsal room... But is it different now that this is what, its third, fourth?
Well, it's complicated. You know, it's had like 20 productions around the country that I haven't had anything to do with, except like sometimes I talk to a director or like get involved a little bit. But I mean, it's kind of amazing. I like stalk the pictures on Instagram and see what the costumes look like and see what the sets look like. But I did the show in New York, and then immediately after I got on a plane and went and did it in London with a different director and a completely new cast and completely new design team, all British. And so for both of those productions, the New York production and the British production, the London production, I was just there the whole time, just like giving birth to the thing. Mm-hmm. Like it was mine. And this is the first time that I've been like back in the room with it since that doubleheader of New York and London. Because I have a relationship with Steppenwolf, and then Lee Sunday Evans, who directed in New York, was going to direct it again in Chicago. And so I wanted to work with her on it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I've sort of been away from it for a while. And this is sort of like my return back
to it. And are you working on it?
No. I maybe shouldn't say that, but no, I'm so not changing. I mean, there are like maybe there will be like three words in the entire text that will be different. It just went from Liverpool, Ohio to Liverpool, Indiana, because I found a little like inaccuracy, and or I didn't. Tim, the director playing dance teacher Pat, did, but it's like I'm not. I wrote this play in 2015, and I also kind of give birth to plays whole. Like, generally, the bones of my plays stay the same after, like, that first draft. So, like, I sort of, like, noodled with it for, like, 3 years leading up to the playwright's production. And, like, once I went through that playwright's production, I was like, okay, for better or worse, this is, like, the text of the play. Maybe in, like, 10 years I'll change my mind, but that's how I feel
right now. Yeah, like a Bright Room Called Day. That Kushner's
doing.
Didn't
just add something. I was
added a whole new character.
Oh my gosh!
And that play is what, like 35 years old.
Yeah, I actually just did a play that I wrote when I was 26, and I did it, which was 7 years ago. I did it in London this fall, called Dirty Crusty, and I didn't change it. I went back. I actually went back to the version that I almost like wrote right when I was 26. I like took out some edits I had made just because I felt like I feel like there's something organic that happens when you write a play at a certain moment in your life, and when you try to, like, fuck with it.
You lose that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was something, when I was just starting to write, somebody pointed me to a published version of Amadeus, and like a foreword or something, a preface to it that, Peter Schaefer, I think, wrote Amadeus.
You're asking the wrong person.
Man, if it's not Peter Schaefer, I'm going to be embarrassed. The author of Amadeus wrote in it how this play had, because it first came out in like 1980. And the published version I was reading was like 2000 or something like that, 2005. And talked about how he kept coming back to the play and revising it after this major, you know, there was a major production on Broadway. It had a motion picture made of it, and he still was coming back to the play and revising it. And I was a brand new playwright, just learning how to be a playwright. And I read that, and it sort of had this impact on me, like, okay, so you're not done. Like, you're done for now. You're always done for now. And maybe for now ends up being forever. But when for now happens, you may come back to it in 7 years or 2 years or 25 or whenever.
I think my problem with that is that I'm just a very nostalgic person. So I'm so aware of how old I was when I was. I also like write my drafts of plays in like 3 weeks. So like when I write like a first draft of a play, the majority of it is coming out of me in like a month. And so I get very, very attached to like what was going on in my life at the time that I was writing and the specific perspective I had at that age.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why I get like a little bit nervous about like messing with stuff after it's sort of set, because like, you know, it actually goes back to this thing that happened to me when I was 6 years old. I remember I was in first or 7 years old. I was in first grade and we did this spelling test at the beginning of the year. And she brought our papers out on the last day of school and showed us our papers so we could see how much we'd learned that year, like how we had learned to spell all these words. And I immediately started to correct all the spelling mistakes. And she was like, no, stop, Claire, like, don't touch that. Like, right. That's like it's like an artifact of like who you were.
Yeah.
And I think there's just part of me that sort of gets very nostalgic for like who I was when I was writing a specific play.
Are you nostalgic? Otherwise, are you nostalgic for like pastimes in your life where you grew up or being in middle school or?
Yeah, I am. I think I have just I don't like change, and I have a complicated relationship with loss. So I'm very afraid of like losing things. I'm someone who I'm a hanger oner, you know, like I have now, but up until the time I was like 30, I had never broken up with a single person in my entire life. And it wasn't that I didn't want to. Like, I had often, like, acted out so that the person would break up with me. Mm-hmm. But, like, I just couldn't handle the thought of, like, losing someone. Or, you know, I'm very much, like, a clinger. Like, I sort of want to, even when it's, like, really bad, I want to just, like, hold on to the bitter end. So, I don't know. I think that's just part of, like, my personality. I also have, like, a really bad memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so I literally can't remember my life as I get, like, further and further away from it. It kind of freaks me out.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a memory problem or if my memory is getting worse or if it has always been this way because I can't remember what my memory was like. Like, I literally can't remember what my memory was like 20 years ago. But I am obsessed with my memory. And it is so my episodic memory, which is like recalling facts and things, is terrible. So I can watch TV shows over and over again. Because I can't really remember. All I can remember is how I feel.
I think I'm similar. I have a strong emotional memory.
Yeah.
But, like, not a strong. And I have a strong, like, a story memory. Like, if something really crazy happens to me, I will remember that story forever.
Yeah.
But I really struggle with which is terrible for the industry we work in. I cannot remember names. I cannot remember faces. I cannot remember. I can't remember conversations. Mm-hmm. So like I have no idea who I've told what.
Mm-hmm.
Which just like all makes life in the theater like a little bit tricky.
A lot bit tricky. I'm really bad with names. I got obsessed with memory a few years ago when I was in grad school, and I was reading a lot of Oliver Sacks. Do you know who Oliver Sacks is?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a ton of Oliver Sacks, and he did all of this research or writing on, because it's always kind of questionable how much research he's actually doing versus how much he's just writing about. But anyway, And it sent me down this rabbit hole about these people who have these no short-term memory, like literally no short-term memory. Something will happen right now, and they'll be able to carry the thread for as long as, like, the connection is maintained and the talking is going on. But as soon as anything breaks, like they turn their head or somebody else enters the room, everything that was just happening is gone. And,
yeah.
they're back to square one. But they remember things from 20 years ago. And I was, like, obsessed with that. And I'm, like, now, for the rest of my life, paranoid that that's my future.
Well, that's the thing, is if my memory has... I know my memory has gotten worse. I also am on, like, drugs, and that's partly what's affecting my memory. So it's hard... I can't tell whether it's, like, being 30, if it's the drugs I'm taking. Like, if my... I don't know what's going on, but I'm, like, I can kind of, like, survive at this level. But if it's going to get worse when I'm, like, 50, then I'm fucked. That's how I feel.
Well, hopefully drugs will evolve to help.
Yeah.
Rather than to
Yeah, I can just take more drugs to, like, counteract right. the side effects of the drugs I'm currently on.
Right, yeah. There we go. I mean, that's sort of, like, the dream of the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
Is that we all have to be on some stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I've been fighting that for a while. The pharmaceuticals. Even aspirin. I struggle. I'm like, do I really need to?
Oh, you don't take aspirin?
It's got to be bad, bad, bad. I'm like, do I want to give Tylenol my money?
Oh, wow.
Do I want to just, like, take a nap?
Wow.
Yeah, I'll give Casper mattress my money instead of Tylenol or Advil.
It's scary. I have bipolar, so I'm on some, like, pretty gnarly psychiatric
yeah.
medication.
Yeah.
And you know, they say that one. Bipolar is a progressive illness, so, like, once you go on them, they're like you're on them for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, like, a very scary thing to, like, think about. And yeah.
When
yeah.
were you diagnosed?
You know, I wasn't diagnosed until I was 30, but the first time I had I was having episodes in my teens.
Mm-hmm.
I just, like, was very good at keeping it a secret.
Was there just not... Oh, okay. You were keeping it to yourself.
Yeah.
It wasn't that nobody had a name to call it. It was just Claire was being Claire.
Yeah. There was one moment in college where I got extreme insomnia. I didn't sleep for, like, 3 months. And I remember calling my parents. They were on the West Coast. I was on the East Coast. So calling them at, like, 4 a.m, waking them up at, like, 1 a.m. And being like, I can't sleep. I don't know what's wrong with me. And they took me to, like, a neurologist or something. And I got all these, like, sleep tests when they sort of like went the, like, medical route rather than the, like, psychiatric route.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I ended up going on sleeping pills for insomnia. But now when I look back at that, I'm just like, obviously I was having a manic episode.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just like, it's just very clear. And I used to joke that the only way I cured that depression cured my insomnia, because I remember right after that 3 month period where I didn't sleep at all, I went into a really deep depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time I started sleeping in, like, 3 months. And I used to joke about it with my friends, like, oh yeah, I got depressed and it cured my insomnia. But actually that was just, like, me swinging from, like, a manic episode to, like, a
mm-hmm.
depressive.
So when you were going through these swings, they weren't obvious to, like, your friends or the people around you?
I mean, I am a pretty weird person, and I think I'm a pretty intense person. So, like, the way people encounter me in the world is as, like, a weird and intense person. But I also, like, have never I've lived a life that is really eclectic. Like, I was in college, and then I moved to New York, and I had all these crazy jobs. I was tutoring. I was selling my dirty underwear to, like, men at $80 a pop. I was, like, writing articles about foot deformities. And then I did, like, this sleep study where I, like, went in a private jet to Switzerland to, like, try to find a new, like, jet lag medication. So I was doing, like, had this very, very eclectic life where I was doing all these very, very different things. And then I ended up eventually, like, working for my boyfriend. He was running a tech startup and he hired me as the office manager, but I was only working 20 hours a week for my boyfriend in a, like, Wild West tech startup office where we, like, regularly all smoked weed together and, like, drank together and, like, it was just like in apartments. So we'd just like shower and like come out in your towel and be like, hey, like it was just like that kind of environment. And then I was doing theater, which allows you to be very intense and allows you to sort of like not do anything for 3 months and then write a play in like 3 weeks. You know, like my whole creative process was very much, I've never been, I have like shame because some writers have like a daily writing practice and I don't, I will not write for like 18 months and then I'll sit down and write a play in 3 weeks. It's just my whole life has always been really like hot and cold. So people, you know, I think people have always been worried about me because I'm highly emotional and stuff. But at the same time, there are so many ways for me to hide. And also, not to be like crass about it, but I was doing well. You know what I mean? Like I was, things were going well in my life. So I think what happens a lot of times when you're succeeding in a certain way that everyone just like assumes that everything is okay.
Right. Yeah.
But I started to get really sick around the time I was in my late 20s, coming up to 30. And I actually like something that happens with bipolar is you're spending so much energy emotionally swinging between these states that it can really wear your immune system down. So I started getting like all these mysterious illnesses. I got like strep six times one summer. I got mono. Wow. I got this weird viral rash, which normally people who have HIV get it, like being people with compromised immune systems. And my weight went down to my seventh grade weight. I weighed the same amount that I weighed when I was 13 years old. And that's when people started coming up to me and sort of being like, are you okay? Like, what's going on?
But you weren't aware.
I don't know if I mean, I also talk about this period, like literally for 2 years of my life, I didn't sleep in a bed. I slept on the floor in a pile of my dirty clothes. Like I would just do the craziest things and somehow I wouldn't think of it as like bad, or I wouldn't think of it as like, I would have like guys come over to date me and they would just sort of laugh about like the crazy girl who like sleeps on the floor. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't even know how to talk about it. I was really struggling, but it was also sort of just part of the like fabric of my life. Like I was used to having this very chaotic, like eccentric life.
And it was your friends saying, hey, we think, are you okay?
It's actually an artistic director of a theater in New York. I mean, who is my friend, but like, it was like a professional person who kind of approached me and was like, you look a little, I mean, I think she was commenting not unkindly on my weight. She was just sort of like something, you don't seem well. Are you okay?
And how did that get you?
Well, it was just pieces. It was pieces. And I another piece came from like, I had really bad acne at the time. And my dermatologist finally said to me, you know, I think this is actually emotional. Like, I don't think this is like, so there were all these little pieces that I was putting together that something was off. But also bipolar intensifies in your late 20s. It kind of like normally onset is like in your teens, but like it generally intensifies in your late 20s if you're not treating it. So I was kind of in some ways like right on schedule.
So you went in and saw somebody?
Well, there's a long there's a long story I'll say for another day, but I had like a little crisis, which led to me getting diagnosed.
Right. And when you were diagnosed, did you then sort of retroactively think back on all of these years and be like, oh, okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why that's why I say the thing about like sleeping on the floor, like mental illness is such a funny thing. If you were to talk about like a mentally ill woman, you would be like, and she sleeps on her carpet in a pile of her dirty clothes. Like that would be like, if you're writing a story about her, that would be like a detail. But like I was doing that, but I thought it was like charming. Do you know what I mean? Like I thought it was like funny. There was a reason I slept on the floor is because I got a kitten and I had a loft bed and the kitten couldn't climb to the loft bed and I wanted to sleep with the kitten. So it started out in this very like cute way. Like I'm just going to like sleep on the floor with my kitten. And then it just like, I just did that for like 2 years.
And then the kitten becomes a cat and is up on your bed looking down at you and be like, you want to come up?
Exactly. Exactly.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Wenatchee, Washington, which is like a small city in eastern Washington state, kind of rural Washington. Feels very, it's like 30,000 people, 35,000 people, but it feels quite rural because the biggest city is 3 hours away. Like Seattle's 3 hours away. Spokane's 3 hours away. So you drive out of Wenatchee. On one side, it's desert. On one side, it's mountains. It's very like nature.
It's desert.
Yeah, because Washington is 2/3 desert, which no one knows.
No, I never knew. I just pictured lots of trees.
Because there's a mountain range in the middle. There's a mountain range that cuts Washington State in half, or more like 1/3 and 2/3. And I remember this from like elementary school, like the clouds come over the ocean and they get very saturated with water. Then they get pushed up the mountain range. And when they get pushed up the mountain range, they are forced to let all their water out. That's why Seattle's so rainy.
Okay.
And all of Western Washington is like a rainforest.
Okay.
By the time they get over the mountains, all their water has been forced out of the clouds. So by the time they get to where I grew up, there's no more water and it's a desert.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, I feel like I need one of those "The More You Know" stars over my head. Were you involved in like performing and?
Yeah. So the crazy thing about where I'm from is it's also where Heidi Schreck is from, and the reason I say this is because Heidi Schreck's mom, Sherry Schreck, founded a children's Shakespeare company called the Short Shakespeareans for kids ages 4 to 14. And that is how I got my start in theater. When I was like 11, I like
performing in kids Shakespeare.
Yeah. I was like 11, which was late to start the program. Like most kids started it when they were like 5 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't get a big part that first year. I was just cast as one of the fairies, but all the other fairies were 4 years old. So like I had to like basically just like babysit the fairies that summer.
One big fairy.
Yeah, there was one. I was the one big fairy in the Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I remember meeting Heidi when I was doing those Shakespeare, because she, I think at the time, was living in Seattle with her husband, Kip Fagan, and they had their theater company and they were doing cool plays and stuff in Seattle, and they would come see Heidi's mom's Shakespeare plays.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start writing?
The first time I met Deb Margolin when I was 17 years old. She's this amazing playwright performer, and she sort of believes that everyone is a writer, like that everyone can write. And so I was actually in like an acting program, but she was doing like a writing workshop for actors.
Mm-hmm.
So she sort of made me believe in myself. And I started writing monologues for myself to perform as an actor. And then Deb ended up teaching at Yale, and I ended up going to Yale. So that sort of like her as an inspiration in my life. She was a huge inspiration in my life. That sort of like continued in college.
Was her going to Yale like the motivation for you? I want to go to Yale.
You know, I was thinking about going to Tisch to I would have been in the Stella Adler studio at Tisch because I wanted to be an actor, and I reached out to her to ask her opinion about whether I should go to Tisch or because I think she was teaching at Tisch at the time, and she said, well, I'm going to Yale and you should come to Yale too. So that it was a big part of the reason I went to Yale.
So did you know her in high school?
No, I did. I did a summer program. I did the Tisch summer acting program.
Oh, okay.
When I was 17.
Yeah.
I was like famously like really like successful at it because I had this older boyfriend who broke up with me right before I went in this really horrible way. And so I was doing all this like Lee Strasberg stuff, and like I just cried all the time because I was just like so upset about having my heart broken. And everyone was like, wow, Claire's such a good actor, she just like cries so it's so moving when she cries. I was really just like sad about my boyfriend.
Is this a relationship that you didn't want to end, but you made it end anyway?
Well, you know, it was kind of an interesting thing. So I grew up in a really Christian community, and everyone was saving themselves for marriage. So I didn't want to have sex until I was married. And my boyfriend, who was older than me at the time, he was sort of like the high school boy who has the beard. You know, like no one else does, but like he has like a full beard.
Right. Did you drive a van too?
He had some old car. I remember some old weird car that we used to make out in, but the Duster or something like that. But I think basically he thought that I was like a good girl.
Mm-hmm.
I to this day, I don't quite know. I think he cheated on me.
Mm-hmm.
I think he very shortly after had sex with someone. And I think he sort of like in some ways just made the decision for me. I think he sort of decided that I was like a good girl who would like never have sex. So he never even asked me. He was never like when we were together, he was never like pushing for anything or sort right. of like I think he's sort of like. And I kind of resent him for that a little bit because like I wish I wish like if that was actually the thing that he would have like had a conversation with me about like what I wanted. Mm-hmm. But I guess we were just like not that emotionally healthy in our relationship.
Right. Well, you were also 17.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's that factor yeah. too.
But it was just very painful because he broke up with me right before prom. And then I didn't have anyone to go to prom with. I remember the night of prom, I stayed home and like studied for the SAT, which was just like very sad and nerdy. And he was just like extremely popular. He was an extremely popular guy. And I was a little bit more of a nerdy girl. And he wasn't very good at like, I remember when he was breaking up with me, it was right before, it was right in the spring. It was right before I had to take this AP test. My mom was so mad that he was like over there the night before my AP test. And it went for like 2 hours. And I was like, wait, are you breaking up with, like, what is happening? You know, like, so, he was so bad at, like, using his words to, like, saying what was happening that it was, like, quite a confusing
I can feel the awkwardness. Like, I have sense memory of this kind of, like, you don't know what to do. You kind of know what you want, but you don't know how to get from point A to point B. So when you were writing, when you started to write these monologues for yourself to perform, do you remember what it is you were writing? Like, what were you giving yourself to do?
Oh, I don't remember. I wonder if I could even find them. Like, I wonder where they even are. I think they were just, like, very personal, very, like, colorful language. I remember at one point, I do remember one moment of one of the monologues where I'd lay on my back and put my legs up in the air. It must have been about sex, and it was talking about there's this Greek myth where, like, this woman gets fucked by Zeus, but he's, like, a sun ray or something. Mm-hmm. Like, he's, like, a ray of light. And so there was something about that story. I can't remember I was telling that story, but there was something about that story. I just remember laying on my back and putting my legs in the air and like gesturing as if there was like sun coming into my pussy or something like that. What were they about? I would have to go find them.
And then you're like, this is what I want to do.
No, I still wanted to be an actor. I wrote plays in college, but I just, to be honest, had no confidence. Like, I was very, very shy to call myself a writer. And when I was 22, when I just graduated college, I sort of, like, sent this play I wrote called Trouble in the Flesh, I think it was. I sort of, like, sent it to all the things, the Public Emerging Writers Group, like, all the things. And it obviously just got rejected from everything. And at the same time, I was dating this 26-year-old novelist who was only 4 years older than me, but felt like 20 years older than me. He was so mature, and I was still very virginal, and he had sex with like 50 women. So it was like this very imbalanced, or probably more than that. Like he had all the sex. I had had no sex. He was like a published novelist. I was like, had my one little play. I was like, you know, and I remember he took me to this literary party, and this famous like novelist or whatever was sort of like holding court, and like all these people were like fawning over him. And he said something about a watch. And I said something about, like, I don't wear watches because it makes me paranoid to strap time to my body. And he, like, whirled around, and he was like, who said that? And I was like, oh, I did. I was, like, playing with the cat on the floor. He was like, are you a writer? And I looked at him, and I couldn't say that I was. Like, I was too afraid, and I was too embarrassed, and I felt too much like a fraud. So I said no. And he said, okay, I'm going to steal that. And from that night, I didn't write for, like, 3 years, basically. I like just completely decided, like I did the opposite of naming myself. I like disnamed myself a writer. I was just sort of,
yeah, because that could have had the opposite impact, right? Like somebody just called out a thought, a sort of literary thought that you had, right?
Yeah.
And it could have been like, oh, maybe I have something.
Yeah, I didn't take it that way. You know, I there was something about like, I mean, I hear you. It could have been like that, but for whatever reason, like my inability to like stand up for myself in that moment. Be like, yes, I'm a writer. I was just too ashamed. So I just stopped. And then I really doubled down on like acting. And I was like waking up at 5 a.m. to go like stand in line and like do equity auditions. And
why
stuff like
is
that.
It why is it harder to say I'm a writer than it is to say I'm an actor?
I think for me, because I did so much acting in college, I was acting in like two plays. I'd been acting since I was 11 years old. So I'd acted all through high school. I'd acted like at least two plays a semester in college. I mean, it shouldn't be, because being an actor is a very scary thing to do.
But you had proof. Like, you had stuff you could point to.
I think
I'm an actor. I did these things.
Yeah. I think I had more.
Yeah.
Where I just had my few little plays that nobody was like paying attention to.
Right. When did that change? When did that shift start to happen?
It happened when I was 25. Like, the whole world at the time, my friend and I were really obsessed with Annie Baker. And she was teaching a program down in Florida at the Atlantic Center for the Arts. And you would go down to Florida with Annie Baker, and she would teach you like every day for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like so fun. And you only needed 10 pages to apply. Mm-hmm. So I found 10 pages that I wrote in college from that play, Trouble in the Flesh. And I sent it to her, and I just crazily like got in,
mm-hmm.
which was just like so shocking. And then I went to Florida. And while I was there, sort of like under her tutelage, I wrote what I sort of consider my first play,
mm-hmm.
in a way, because it was really my first play as a grown-up person, where I wasn't just trying to copy someone or do something. I feel like the plays I wrote in college, I was just like literally trying to write out Edward Albee.
Mm-hmm.
And then Annie helped me get into Young Blood, which is a playwrights program in New York for playwrights under 30. Mm-hmm. She like put in a good word for me and like told me to apply. And then once I got into Young Blood, I started to have like an identity as a writer, because then I was like in a writer's group. I still wasn't calling myself a playwright at this time. I still called myself an actor.
But clearly you wanted to be a writer, right? Because you wouldn't go through all of these things if you didn't actually really want to be a writer.
I think so, but I think I wanted to be like, I think the thing I wanted to be was like an artist in any shape or form. Like, I think I would have taken it in any shape or form.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if my acting career, I really pursued my acting career for like 3 years. If my acting career had been going better,
mm-hmm.
I might not have applied to that Annie Baker program.
Right,
you know, like
right,
if I, because I got my Equity card and I was acting in shows, but it was just like little pieces here and there. I wasn't a successful actor at all by any means.
Or satisfied.
Oh, I wasn't satisfied. Yeah. But if I had been satisfied, if I had been like working a lot on really exciting projects, I might never have applied to that program. I might have just been like, great, I'm an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think something in my soul wanted to be a writer. I when I was like 6 years old, I wanted to be a writer. That was like the first thing I wanted to be before I decided I wanted to be like a wildlife biologist instead. But like, there's something in my soul that has always been very drawn to writing. I do think it's true. Yeah.
Was anybody in your family a writer or artistic or theatrical in any way?
No.
How do you think you come out of a family like that? Because I come out of a similar family, I can't relate to anybody in my family, because nobody has done anything creative.
Yeah, so my mom is a social worker. My dad was an engineer. That's like what they studied. But they're very, very creative people. You know, they're extremely creative people. So I think I still got a big dose
of... In what way?
Well, my dad writes a little bit, and but more in his later life. You know, like not... Well, no, he showed me a poem once. He wrote about my mom when they first met. But he just loves to read, and he loves, like, good movies, and he loves music. Like, he's very...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He's very, like, steeped in the arts. And my mom, I mean, both of them... It's like my mom produced... So in Wenatchee, we would do these high school musicals with, like, 100 kids in them,
mm-hmm.
and the budget would be like $40,000, because we would sell out our 1,000-seater auditorium for like 10 nights, and mm-hmm. it would be like $10 a ticket, so we'd make all this money. We'd have these very fancy musicals, and my mom was the producer of these musicals. And just like, even the way she puts together her like producer binder that says like she would make these binders so that future generations would mm-hmm. know like how to do it.
Yeah.
It was just like so beautiful and like so creative and like so well done. So that's what I just mean. Like, she's just like a creative person.
Right. Well, there's, so your family, the individuals are not particularly in the arts per se, but there was an environment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
When you were in that class with Annie Baker, did you have like, so this is where you wrote your first play.
Yeah.
Was there like an aha moment? Was there like a thing like, oh, now I feel like I know how to do this?
I just felt like really free. You know, Annie was using a bunch of Mac Wellman exercises mm-hmm. and things. And she was borrowing from like Young Jean Lee and all sorts of Kristen Cosmos, I think, and all sorts of other amazing playwrights. And so I was being introduced to all these really adventurous, cool playwrights. And then I was being introduced to all these sort of like exercises that were designed to sort of like free you up, you know, like mm-hmm. the classic ones, like write a really bad play or like write the play that you hate the most. And so I think this clenching I had done in college when I wrote, where I was just trying to write something good, kind of went away.
Yeah.
And I just started to sort of like play basically a lot more. And it was very, it came out of me like very naturally. It was very mm-hmm. fun. Like I was full. I also think the best thing I ever did was like walk away from it for 3 years. Cause I think, and I haven't written a play in 3 years right now. The last play I wrote was in the spring of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of feel like I'm in another moment where I just had to sort of like step away. I'm waiting for that moment where like the words like come back to me and it's just sort of like easy and fun again. Cause what I remember from that summer is that it was just like easy and fun.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of my best writing experiences have been easy and fun.
So here it's 2019 right now.
Uh-huh.
And you haven't written since
2016.
Wow. I write every day.
You do?
I
can't do that.
Monday through Friday.
Okay.
I write every day. And it's like amazing because you have plays going on all over the place, so it seems like you're writing.
They're all old. You know? Yeah.
I know, but you know that, right? I think the civilians don't know that. So it's kind of amazing to hear. So how are you feeling, or are you feeling artistically fulfilled by traveling to your plays? Or
well, so yeah, I mean, I've been really busy these last 3 years, and I've also been working in television. So mm-hmm. so it's not like I've written a pilot. I've written, so I haven't like not written at all. But that feels so different than like a play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like feels so different than like a play you're writing for yourself. But I've it's just been a combination of like being in production,
mm-hmm.
And doing TV.
Do you like writing for television?
I don't know yet. I'm still trying to figure it out. I haven't found the same like looseness and freedom in screenwriting that I feel in playwriting. And yeah. I've done a couple like development deals where I'm writing my own stuff. And then I've also done a couple rooms where I'm like writing for other people. And in mm-hmm. some ways I like the rooms better because it's just like, okay, a job, but in a good, it's like a fun job.
Right.
But I'm still looking for the moment where I feel like really loose and free and good mm-hmm. and inspired, like while writing a pilot.
Right, right. Yeah, there's some kind of alchemy with the subject, what you're writing.
Yeah.
The people you're
and
working
the form.
With. Yeah. Yeah. But I just like to talk to people about the feeling of writing for a TV show versus the feeling of writing a play because it is so different.
Yeah. One feels very personal and the other feels like a job to me. But a job isn't a bad thing.
It's right. Just, right. I mean, we all have them, you know. Yeah. I work at a community college. What's wrong with working for a TV show? To pay the bills. When you're working in TV, are you able to find ways to put yourself in the work?
For sure. But I get like really, whenever I staff, I'm a person who like overshares a lot. And so mm-hmm. like, I'll talk a lot in the room about like personal stuff. And then I'll be like, wait a minute, I'm telling like a room full of 10 writers, like all my best stories and like personal secrets.
Right,
and
right.
I don't necessarily like want these stories going into this like television show. So it's like a funny balance between like contributing your heart and your soul and also like keeping some of it.
But the writer's room is supposed to be like a safe space, right?
Yeah.
Where people are free to talk about their dark secrets.
Yeah,
and
they do.
And whatnot.
They do. And I sort of like, you know, lead the charge on that because I do like overshare so much. So I'm definitely the personality in the writer's room who's just like, this is like my traumatic experience.
Right, right. Are you on a show now?
No, I'm not. Mm-mm.
Are you eager to get back there?
No, I just did a show for about 5 months. So now I'm sort of like taking a break.
It's like you're in a good spot.
Yeah, I try not to do them like back to back.
Right. Okay, so going back again, I am slowly, even though we're jumping around, I am kind of slowly moving forward in time, in my mind anyway. Do you remember that moment where you're like, I'm a writer?
No, I don't. I think I didn't say that I was a playwright for an embarrassing amount of time, but I do remember a really intense moment. So I my first production ever was a Club Thumb Summer Works. It was a play called Baby Screams Miracle. And I do remember just like how intense tech felt watching all of these people like working on something that you wrote. Like it's just like such a crazy, you know, I've yet to be in a tech where I haven't cried because I just felt overwhelmed by like the number of people like working on your show. It's very, it's just like very moving. And I remember when I watched Baby Screams Miracle, that summer works, I literally would sob through the whole play. Like I would just sit, and all the designers must've thought I was crazy, but I would sit in the back row and I would just be silently like tears streaming down my face because I almost couldn't hear the play. Like I almost couldn't like listen. I don't even know how that play went. I don't know if I liked it. I don't know anything about it because I was just sitting in the back of the room like crying. So I feel like that's the moment where I remember something like happening.
Because the thing that you sat down and wrote and bared your soul was becoming a thing for all.
Yeah, but not in a like egotistical way. It's more just like I felt really overwhelmed. Like I felt like really overwhelmed that all of these other people were like giving their time to something that I made. Like if anything, it made me feel like a little bit like embarrassed or a little bit like I hope this is worth it for everyone. You know, like I always feel whenever I have a show, I just really want it to be a good experience for the actors and for the designers and for the director. Like I always am sort of like hopeful that people like get something out of it, that it means something to them. And I just found it very overwhelming that that would ever happen, that you would ever like write something and then, because there's so many people who make a play happen, especially a place like Steppenwolf. You know, like a big theater like this, you have the first day and the number of people in the room is just like staggering. You're just like, wow, I can't believe that. Like,
so you still feel that way?
I still feel that way. I still feel that way for sure.
I first became acquainted with your work when they did You Got Older here. And a friend of mine brought me to, she had an extra ticket, and she brought me to see the show. And I was stunned by the show.
That's so
like,
nice.
I loved it. I just loved it so much. And I came back and I had to bring my girlfriend with me because she needed to see it.
Well, that's so nice.
I'm just going to fanboy for a second, so you can put your microphone down and, but, I'm not kidding. So like what you're talking about before about, I hope it's worth it. That play was so unbelievably worth it to me because it had literally every single thing that I yearn for when I go to the theater. Like I want to be shown something, I've never seen before. I want to feel things and I don't want to just feel a thing. I want to feel happy, sad, umami, right? I want all of it. It was just so joyous and so sad. And then the way it ended, and I won't say how it's ending in case people have never seen it and they're going to see it one day, because I hope everybody listening gets to see this play. In the last moment, or the last, you don't know what's the last moment, but when the actors come back on stage, I'm thinking, oh, yes, this is, I can't believe, like, I didn't know that was going to happen. And then as it's happening, I'm like, please end like this. Please end like this. Please end like this. I wanted this to be the takeaway emotion and the feeling. And it did. And that's never happened to me in the theater before, where my feeling and the trajectory of my feelings and the trajectory of the play came together in the final moment at blackout. And I just sat there and my mouth was like, totally agape. And so I feel like I want to thank you for that, because I felt like it was such a gift. And then I was able to re-gift it to another person who enjoyed it too, and to experience it a second time. It was actually more emotional, like, because the first time you don't know what's coming and things are surprising. And so at the end of the second time, like, I was crying rather than like, oh, is this gonna happen? Did it happen? So that's the end of my little fanboy rant.
That's so nice. That's so nice.
And I've been a fan ever since.
That's so nice.
And I rarely have these, like, there are a few playwrights whose work has moved me so much and inspired me, and then I get to have a conversation with them. So,
So nice.
I'm very excited about this because of that. And it also has me excited about seeing Dance Nation, which we started talking about a little bit at the beginning of our conversation. And that's the thing that's happening at Steppenwolf right now. This is another play that you probably wrote many years ago because you haven't written for, for many years. And it's been done all over the place. But can you go back to when this started? Actually, you know, let me rephrase this question and maybe I'll just edit this part out. Because there's a because this ties to something else I'm curious about. You talked about how your plays come out virtually fully formed, and they come out rather quickly, 3 weeks or so, you said. But what's happening in the time period before you set it down? Like, are you living with this for a while? Because it is kind of an Albee thing, right? Like, he always said he's done. He writes a first draft and he doesn't rewrite. Whatever comes out, comes out. But is there, like, a lot of pre-work going on for you?
Yeah, so my plays all have, like, extreme emotional origins. So, like, you were just talking about You Got Older, and that play is very, very much about, like, my experience with my dad having cancer. And, like, I literally, like, wrote that play in his hospital room, like, while it was happening. So that play was a little bit different because I wrote it over the course of a year, but I wrote it in very, like, intense situations. I don't know if you want to edit this part out or not, but I always have to say, like, that play is so complicated for me because, spoiler, like, in the play, the dad dies, but my dad actually survived. So it's like, I was writing it in a period where we didn't know if he was going to survive or not, like, in this liminal state. And so the whole sort of, like, play, like, exists in this liminal state. And then that production happened very suddenly. So I wrote my first draft of the play, and I had a public reading for the Soho Rep Writer Director Lab in New York. And the next day I got a call from Page 73, which is this small company in New York that does world premieres. New York premieres of, like, you can't have ever had a production in New York City. I had a Club Them Summer Works, but somehow they, like, made that
doesn't
work.
Count. They just made it was in the summer.
Yeah, it was it was in the summer. Anyway, they were like, we want to produce the show. And I hadn't even told my parents that I'd written the show. And my dad hadn't even been, like, we didn't even know what was happening with my dad. So it was a very emotional phone call to be like, hey, I have to tell you this, like, da da da. Lucky for me, I think my parents at that point were extremely anxious about me being a struggling artist. So I feel like I could have told them I wrote a play about their assholes and they would be like, yay, you have a production. You know, like, they're just like so wanting me to do well. But the play went up in New York less than a year. It wasn't even a year. It wasn't even the year anniversary of events in the play. So I was like, that tech, I was watching that tech. And it hadn't even been a year, because also in that play, the woman, she's in a 5-year relationship, and it's just backstory of the play. It's not like the plot of the play, but her boyfriend breaks up with her and then fires her. And that's literally what happened to me. I was working for my boyfriend at that tech startup, and we broke up, and then he fired me.
Right.
And so, like, the play was extremely emotional to me for a lot of reasons. I remember, like, sitting in tech, waiting to hear about, like, my sister was going to text me about, like, a scan of my dad's to see if it was, like, clean or not. And I was literally, like, sitting in tech waiting for this text message from my sister to tell me about, like, my dad's health. And I remember
You're in tech for a play inspired by
And I remember getting the text and seeing that he was clear and literally just, like, face planting into Annie Kaufman's lap, who was directing the show, and just, like, crying. And then that show became so complicated for me. I'm making my way back to Dance Nation slowly, but that show became so complicated for me because it changed my life. That show actually did not get a good New York Times review, but a lot of people became sort of, like, obsessed with that show, and the New York theater community really, like, rallied around that show, and it ended up, like, winning an Obie and being nominated for a bunch of stuff and all that kind of noise, and also I got TV and film agents off of that show. And then I used that show as my TV and film sample and got, like, a development deal off of that show, which was, like, how I supported myself for the next, like, 2 years. I went into, like, a deep depression because I think I felt so weird and guilty that this thing that came out of the most painful incident in my family's life was now bringing me literally money, was bringing me like awards. Right. It was bringing me like all the success. I didn't know how to process that.
What did your parents say? What did your dad say about, did they see it?
Yeah, they saw it. And that was the other most terrifying. Like I literally thought, not to be crude, but I literally thought I was going to shit myself. I was like that nervous with them. I didn't watch it when they watched it. I stayed outside and they watched it and they're so funny. I don't even know what that, you know, parents are so funny when they come and see your plays.
Yeah.
They say the funniest things. My dad said he should have gotten a co-writing credit, which he should have because like a lot of the stories in the play are his stories. I think they were just very overwhelmed. And so I don't even know if they,
but nothing they said actually sort of helped you deal with all those feelings you were feeling?
I don't think I was talking to them about those feelings. Yeah. I think I can't remember anymore, but I don't think I was really communicating to my parents about the complications that I felt about that. Yeah. And I think that they were really excited whenever I had success. You know, like my parents are just huge cheerleaders and they're just always wanting me to do well. And so like, I think they saw the success of that. I don't think they felt anything weird about the success of that play. Like they saw the success of that play as only a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just like really proud and excited. And I was sort of like secretly having complicated feelings about it.
And mom wasn't upset that she wasn't dramatized?
No. I felt guilty about it because the mom in the play is dead. And it's just like such, I feel like that's truly just like such a dramatic thing of like, wanting to delve deep with one parent and like you're like, okay, I can't deal with the other parents.
So much easier.
Yeah. No, but I felt weird about that. And then there was a funny thing with there's all these moms in Dance Nation and I had to and they're like not the best of moms and I had to be like, Mom, you are not the moms in Dance Nation. Like don't worry. I don't know how she felt about that. I guess we don't talk about my work like that closely. You know, we sort of like talk about it.
Right.
From a distance.
Right. Like the business of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I interrupted you, you were about to talk about.
Well, it's just that the two plays are linked because some of the shame I felt at the success of You Got Older is partly what inspired Dance Nation, because Dance Nation is about ambition and success and like being the winner and complicated feelings about all of those things. And there's a character in the play called Amina, who's like the star dancer. And she just like has a lot of guilt about taking up too much space, basically. And she doesn't understand how to like be her best version of herself and also like not be an asshole. Like she doesn't know, she just feels very guilty all the time about she like wants the part in the play, but she also feels like guilty for getting the part. And mm-hmm. I feel like in no ways am I that character, but like some of those themes of like guilt and shame surrounding success came out of like my experience with You Got Older, where like all this great stuff was happening to me, but I just sort of felt like shit. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of felt like bad about myself.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
So were you living with this for a while before you wrote Dance Nation?
No, I wrote Dance Nation in the spring after You Got Older. So
You Got Older came out in like real time.
Fall 2014. And then I wrote Dance Nation March 2015.
So where are you now, I guess, emotionally with your work? You haven't written in a few years.
Yeah. I think part of the reason I haven't written in a few years is, so again, I feel like my plays come out of like very, I have this other play that not very many people saw, but it's maybe my favorite thing I've ever done called I'll Never Love Again. And I made it out of my 15-year-old diary, basically, about my first relationship. And like that play came out of basically being in a, I don't want to say abusive relationship, but I was in a really toxic, unhealthy relationship where bad things happened with another playwright. And I think I was sort of like, how did I like end up in this terrible relationship? And so I went back to my first relationship and sort of like excavated it. And so I'm just sharing that to say that like all of these plays come out of like, they came out of like what I was dealing with in my life at that moment. And, you know, the thing I've been dealing with in my life for the past 3 years is like mental health. And I think it's just really hard to write about. You know, I've tried, I think that's the thing that I have to write about. And, I just haven't found my way. I haven't found my way in. I haven't found my way to do it yet.
Are you saying for you in your process, there is a particular place you need to be in sort of mentally, emotionally in order for it to come out?
No, I think I'm saying that like I tend to write about the hot spot of my life. So the thing in my life that is filling up, that is actually upsetting me. And the thing in my life that is actually been upsetting me is mental health, but for whatever reason, you know, I could write about my dad's cancer, I could write about my weird feelings about career stuff, I could write about like an abusive ex, but like I somehow like can't write about mental illness for whatever reason.
Because the subject's you?
I don't know. I actually don't know the answer to that question. I've tried. I've had a couple plays that have kind of misshapenly come out. But yeah, I just haven't quite found my way. I haven't quite found my way in.
Do you think about the future, like goals, like what you want to write one day? I have this idea for a big blah, 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 or whatever.
No, I don't. Maybe I should. Mostly I just want to keep making work that, like, I never want to be a sellout. The most important thing, like, is to make work that connects with people. And I feel like thus far, my plays have had like intense emotional connections with people, and that's the thing that I value more than anything else. I don't want it to feel like a normal night at the theater. I want someone coming to see a play of mine to feel like have an intense emotional experience. And so like mostly what I think I'm afraid of in life is like losing that, or sort of like starting to write stuff that's more generic, or starting to write stuff that's just like a play for the sake of a play.
And that's what selling out would be to you?
Yeah, like
I made air quotes for those who couldn't see.
I feel like sometimes I see plays of certain playwrights and I'm like, did you really need to write that play, or were you just like writing a play because you could? And Deb Margolin, again, my first teacher, she always used to say to us, write today what you would need to say if you were to die tomorrow. So if you were going to be off the planet tomorrow, what do you need to say? And I'm kind of only interested in stuff that falls in that category. And it can be silly. It can be like, I need to like reenact a commercial. Like that's what I like need to do. But it's just like that urgency and that need. And I think that's partly why I haven't written. It's just like, I'm not feeling that thing. And so I could just write a play. I mean, I get sort of icked out when I feel like I see certain writers being strategic about like what they're writing about. Like I could sit here right now and like think about my career and like think about like a good subject for me to write a play on that would be like I didn't write Dance Nation about 13-year-old girls because I thought it was like hip to write about like teenage girls. Like I was writing it because I was obsessed with a reality show called Dance Moms and was binging it and like watching it all. I don't like to think about like what would be a good play. Mm-hmm. It has to sort of like come out of me. And so I guess when it doesn't come out, it doesn't come out, when you just like wait and you just like wait and you just wait and you just have to have faith that like it eventually will come out of you again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's what I hope anyway.
Yeah, I feel that. I do. I think that's a good place to stop.
Cool.
I super appreciate this, and it was a joy to meet you.
So nice to meet you.
So thank you.
So nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you to Claire and to Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. Dance Nation is playing through the beginning of February 2020. Go see it. And seriously, you've got to see You Got Older if you can. And if you can't see it in production, find yourself a copy of the script. I really, really, really love it and want you to love it too. Music from this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions. The theme song for the subtext is High by International Pen Pal. The Subtext is brought to you by American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group, and is produced and hosted by me. Thank you for listening. Normally, this is a moment when I tell you about the play filling me up this month, but what's been on my mind lately is the musical In the Heights. I just got finished working on a production of it with some really wonderful people, and the trailer for the movie adaptation just came out. So, when you can, go see the In the Heights movie. It will make you feel good, I promise.